This is the MyHeart.net podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Philip Johnson in conjunction with VitalEngine.com. Please welcome your host, Dr. Alain Bouchard, of Cardiology Specialist of Birmingham, Alabama, at St. Vincent's Medical Center, part of Ascension.
Welcome to our podcast on MyHeart.net on the rising star, the factor 11, how it is a promising anticoagulant for the future. And with us today, we have Dr. Kenneth Mahaffey, a professor of medicine at Stanford University. And also with us, and Dr. Michael Gibson, who's CEO of the BAM Institute for Clinical Research at Harvard. So gentlemen, thank you very much for participating in this podcast, which should be very interesting for our patients that need blood thinners.
Thanks for having me.
So we'll try to talk today about how the body makes blood clots in the first place and why is it important for us. We'll talk after that about how sometimes a blood clot is abnormal and can be dangerous to us, and what are the mechanisms or ways that we could actually treat blood clots. Finally, we'll talk about two clinical situations. The first one will be atrial fibrillation. We'll discuss that with Dr. Mahaffey. And then we'll finish up by how blood clots can be very damaging and can be very dangerous in the setting of an acute coronary syndrome or a heart attack after a heart attack with Dr. Gibson. So let's start, Kenny, let's start with you. And tell us a little bit, what is factor 11 and why does the body need to form blood clots?
Yeah, exactly. There is a system in our body called the coagulation cascade or coagulation system that is there because if we cut ourselves, we need to stop the bleeding. And the way our body stops the bleeding is forming blood clots, or the medical term is a thrombus. And that coagulation system has a series of factors that all interact with one another to form the blood clot. Very important, as I've said, when we hurt ourselves or cut ourselves, but it can also be detrimental when the blood clots form in places or at times when we don't want them to.
That's very good. Let's talk about that a little bit more, Michael. Let's talk when a blood clot is not normal. We know that blood clots kill people. It's probably responsible for about a quarter of the deaths, you know, worldwide whenever it occurs. Blood clots in your lungs, in your coronary arteries, creating a heart attack, or sometimes with a stroke. So, what is the role of factor 11 in that situation? And is there a way to actually uncouple the risk of bleeding with the risk of the blood clot per se?
Yeah, well, a lot of us went into cardiology because we were, you know, scared to memorize that whole blood clotting cascade that Ken just described. But, you know, there are good clots and bad clots. And the good clots are the ones that prevent you from bleeding, as Ken said. That's mediated by what's called the extrinsic pathway. But then there are the bad blood clots that you described, Elaine, which are the ones that form inside blood vessels. And that is where that factor 11 lives. It lives over on the side of the clotting cascade of the bad clots. And what we're doing by inhibiting factor 11 is we're allowing the good clots to form and preventing over on the other side, on the intrinsic pathway side, the bad clots from forming. And, you know, we have some examples in nature. When people hear the word hemophilia, they get very scared about bleeding, but there's different types of hemophilia. There is a type of hemophilia where you have factor 11 deficiency, where you don't bleed that much. You don't bleed really much spontaneously, but you don't have strokes or clotting events. And that's what we're trying to mimic. You know, we're trying to mimic nature in that regard.
That's great. Well, let's talk about the clinical situation, Kenny. If we could pursue with a discussion of anticoagulation and AFib. We know that AFib is so prevalent, particularly when we're older. I mean, there's almost 10% of the population after the age of 65 that has atrial fibrillation. So We've been preventing stroke with anticoagulation. And years ago, obviously, we had warfarin or Coumadin. Of course, for patients with a prosthetic mechanical prosthetic valve, that's the only option that we have. But for the other patient, we have a lot of options. But all of us, you know, are a fear of bleeding and having our patients bled. And I think if we've been in practice long enough, all of us have had patients that have had intracranial bleed, that have had to have surgery, burr hole to evacuate a subdural, or sometimes even, unfortunately, have lost patient because of that. So 15 years ago, we started having these direct anticoagulation anticoagulants, like the DOAX. And the rivaroxaban was the first, you know, player. 3 years later, we have apixaban or Eliquis, and really it's changed the landscape for our patients with AFib. We can reduce the risk of stroke to maybe 1-1.5% per year, but we still have the problem with bleeding, particularly in the elderly or patients with renal failure. So how do you think factor 11, you know, could help us change the landscape in patients with AFib? And some of the preliminary data that we have that could make us feel good about preventing, you know, a stroke while reducing the risk of bleeding? And where do we go from there? What are the current trials ongoing on the factor 11?
Yeah, you've laid the landscape very nicely that there are millions, if not tens of millions of people with atrial fibrillation. And in atrial fibrillation increases our risk of stroke. And the challenge is that when people have strokes with atrial fibrillation, they are often very large strokes. People suffer a lot of consequences neurologically and can often die from those strokes. The challenge that we have in clinical practice today is, even though we've made tremendous advances in the management of atrial fibrillation and we have new blood thinners that have been available for only 10 or 15 years, there is still the concern that when you take these blood thinners, that there is an increased risk of bleeding. And the trials show that for many of the drugs and specific types of bleeding. Because of this, we often undertreat and by not treating at all or using lower dosages than were actually studied in the trials. So drugs in the future, perhaps factor 11, that may decrease the chance of clot forming with atrial fibrillation and the subsequent stroke, but not increase the risk of bleeding, or perhaps even decrease the risk of bleeding, would be really important both for clinicians that are working with patients and patients and their families in shared decision-making about the best way to treat this disease. Well, we're fortunate because there are a number of factor 11 inhibitors or drugs that block factor 11, as Michael described, that have started to go through clinical trials. We now have trials in people who have had knee surgery who are at risk for blood clots forming in the legs. We have had trials in people who have had strokes. We have had trials in people with atrial fibrillation and trials in people with heart attacks or acute coronary syndromes. All of these trials were relatively small. They are called what we call phase two clinical trials. They are for us to understand the drug, understand what dose may be the best dose to move forward with. But I think they've shown us some very important things. One, that the factor 11 inhibitors can potentially either have a similar amount of bleeding or less bleeding than the drugs that we are using to typically treat these conditions that have been studied so far, and that there's been no increase in risk of clots, strokes, or heart attacks. So very promising data from this early work that's now laying the foundation for large global phase three definitive clinical trials with some of these factor 11s.
There are several, you know, trials, as you mentioned, what are the current ones that are you involved right now, Ken?
Yeah, I think that there are two large factor 11 programs that are moving forward in atrial fibrillation space. One is the Oceanic program that is being sponsored by Bayer Pharmaceuticals. And there's a second large program that I'm personally involved with, and that's the Librexia program that's sponsored by Janssen Pharmaceuticals and Bristol-Myers Squibb.
So this is kind of a pill that you give the patient, or is it an injection? Or?
The factor 11 inhibitors that are being studied in both of these large programs, these are programs with 15 to 20,000 patients planned to be enrolled all over the world. These are both pills, oral pills that you take on a daily basis.
Terrific. Sounds very promising, and I can't wait to get started actually in enrollment. Michael, let's move to the field of acute coronary syndrome or heart attack. I mean, I think I can't think of any other investigators that have done so much work in that field. I feel like you're like the father of the research in acute coronary syndrome from the time of thrombolytics to the Timiflow to so involved in the post-MI secondary prevention and how can you prevent another heart attack. So I think this is very, very important. If we take a situation of a patient with a heart attack, I mean, currently the best treatment is they come quickly to the hospital, we reopen the artery the artery that was closed by a blood clot, we reopen it with a stent, and we treat our patients with aspirin and an antiplatelet medication, whether it's clopidogrel or prasugrel or ticagrelor. And the patients usually do pretty well, and they feel like they're already on two anticoagulants. But over the years, particularly in the last 10 years, you've done a lot of research and you've been a proponent for adding a third anticoagulant to really reduce the risk of another heart attack, or sometimes even to reduce the risk of stroke. So what is the data that really kind of makes you feel like we need to go a step further and add a third anticoagulant in the patients after a heart attack? What is the current studies that you're involved that to study that, and particularly the ones involving the factor 11?
Well, we've made a lot of progress over the years, as you suggest. The problem is people are still having events. And there has been a tendency to want to stop antiplatelet therapy earlier and earlier and earlier. We have newer stents and more aggressive lipid lowering. The platelets kind of calm down a little bit after that acute period. So it kind of makes sense, to back off a bit. On the other hand, what we have really discounted is the importance of thrombin. And thrombin is, those little fibrin strands that float around. They are the connectors in the, between the platelets. Thrombin makes your platelets very angry. It's the most potent agonist of platelets. And ticagrelor, clopidogrel, prasugrel, aspirin, none of them do anything to prevent thrombin from activating your platelets. So while we're doing a great job preventing stent thrombosis, and we're all very happy about that as interventional cardiologists, there's a patient attached to the stent, and that patient is at risk of secondary events in other arteries, and we aren't doing a lot for secondary prevention. So thrombin is elevated in these patients. It's elevated for years after the ACS event. I like to say thrombin is the new cholesterol. We do know that those elevated thrombin levels are associated with worse outcomes. So it's a great natural biologic target for chronic therapy. We've done this 4 times now. We've done it in Atlas I, Atlas II, Compass, with Vorapaxar in another mechanism. All 4 studies have shown a reduction in the primary endpoint, including reductions in mortality when you reduce thrombin generation. So it seems like a viable target. Now, on the other hand, people don't like bleeding. And we did see an excess risk of bleeding when you added rivaroxaban on top of dual antiplatelet therapy. I will note the increase in bleeding was similar to the increase in bleeding that you see with ticagrelor over clopidogrel, 0.6% per year major bleeding. But for some reason, people wouldn't tolerate that in our treating community. So we need something safer. That's where factor 11 inhibition comes in. It does look like from some of the data Ken mentioned and other preliminary data that we can inhibit those bad clots within the arteries, but preserve hemostasis, the good clots. And that's why we're so excited. The hypothesis seems valid that inhibiting thrombin will improve outcomes. We've done that four times now. Now we're just going to show, hopefully, that we can do it safely. And that's the promise of factor 11.
What are the current trials that you're involved, Michael, to study exactly that question?
Well, I only know what I'm really doing, and that's a trial of a drug called Milvexian, which is one oral twice a day factor 11 inhibitor after an MI. There may be some other approaches to this by other companies. Bayer has tabled their efforts right now. Doesn't mean they won't go back. So we'll see. We'll see what emerges.
Pretty exciting. I think factor 11, a new rising star. And with all these clinical trials, you know, ongoing, and I think for the patient, particularly the patient participated in the clinical study, first of all, we want to thank you, you know, for this. I think you're helping us advancing the science and making it, you know, better medicine for the patient. You're helping potentially not only yourself, but also all the other patients out there. But make sure that you follow up, you know, with your doctor and follow up with the clinical nurse and as well as the research nurse, because every patient is so important. And I know Michael stresses that a lot. You know, no patient should be left behind or unaccounted for, because we want to make sure that the drugs that are being studied are safe and make sure that we have, you know, a good medication to offer our patient 5 to 10 years from now.
Yeah, I like to say that a patient who goes missing, it's worse to have that patient in the trial than not have enrolled them. It really penalizes us when we go to look at the data. So we were going to redouble our efforts to make sure we get people in the trial who are going to stay in the trial. People who signed up for the study signed up with the idea that we're going to answer the question. If people drop out, it makes it really hard for us to answer the question. So we've really redoubled our efforts to make sure we get really good follow-up in these trials.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much, Kenneth Mahaffey and Mike Gibson. A great collaboration between Stanford and Harvard, and really quite exciting to be enrolling patients, participating in the research. Thank you, folks.
Well, thank you for joining us. I mean, we really appreciate your efforts.
Thank you so much.
To learn more from our team of cardiologists, please visit us at myheart.net. You can also follow us on social media by searching myheart.net on Facebook and Twitter. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss our next episode.